Imagine a donut. The end goal is coming into that sweet spot. The outer ring of the donut is representing the planet's boundaries.
Circularity, that's where companies make money.
We're at square one.
Regulation does have a key role to play in encouraging companies to make the right choices. Technology will help to a certain extent, but it's not going to solve the problem. We reach a very influential audience of senior decision makers. We talk about brain print.
The city of Vienna has done some excellent work, come up with the brand Made in Vienna.
Das ist ein Weg in die Wirtschaft von morgen. Willkommen bei Full Circle, dem Podcast über Kreislaufwirtschaft und wie das in der Praxis wirklich funktioniert. Ich bin Nadja Hahn. Ich spreche mit Menschen, die Lösungen finden, wie wir Rohstoffe länger im Kreislauf halten, damit Geld verdienen und der Umwelt etwas Gutes tun. Sie haben es ja schon gehört, heute ist eine besondere Folge, weil ich habe einen Gast aus Großbritannien und deshalb sprechen wir auch gleich weiter auf Englisch. Aber zuerst mal stelle ich meinen Gast vor. Ich begrüße Emily Jackson vom renommierten britischen Wirtschaftsmagazin The Economist. Sie ist dort für Nachhaltigkeit zuständig und sie ist für die Impact Days nach Wien gekommen und ich freue mich sehr, dass sie hier mit uns über Kreislaufwirtschaft spricht. Wir möchten von ihr wissen, wie ticken die großen internationalen Konzerne und das wollen wir sie heute fragen. Hello, Emily. Thanks for being here.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
Auch bei mir ist Marina Heiden. Sie vertritt Donut Vienna.
Hallo.
Hallo.
Die sogenannte Donut-Ökonomie ist ein Konzept der Britin Kate Raworth. Sie hat 2018 ein Buch geschrieben mit dem Titel Die Donut-Ökonomie – Endlich ein Wirtschaftsmodell, das den Planeten nicht zerstört. Marina bringt das Thema nach Wien und erklärt uns gleich, was das ist. Marina ist Österreicherin und hat eine lange internationale Karriere in der Medienbranche und in der Nachhaltigkeitsberatung. So, let's switch to English. Marina, can you please explain very briefly what the donut economy is and what has it got to do with pastry and what has it got to do with the circular economy?
So first, imagine a donut in front of us. So everybody knows that a donut is effectively a circle with a hole in the middle. And the nice part about the donut is, of course, the sweet spot that you can actually eat. So the end goal is coming into that sweet spot where we have some wonderful substance to be able to enjoy. The donut doesn't make sense as a concept without explaining what the rings of the donut entail. So the outer ring of the donut is representing the planet's boundaries, which are resource thresholds on the one hand, and on the other hand, risk levels. So climate, biodiversity, water, these are all areas where we need to have functioning ecosystems to be able to survive as humanity. And the inner ring of the donut is effectively the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals. This is basically achieving a good place, good means for people to be able to thrive with life's essentials, basically.
Okay. And so the economy that we're looking for is the sweet spot, is the dough.
Yes.
Okay. Just to complete the image. So to sum this up, we're moving away from a linear economy and how we deal with raw materials. In English, you talk about take, make, waste, and we're moving to a regenerative model. Emily, you are in charge of sustainability at The Economist, and you will talk to us about the publishing business on the one hand and about the journalism on the other. But first, what brought you to Vienna?
So I came to Vienna to talk at Impact Days about some of the tensions that are facing our world in sustainability. It's a challenging time. We have seen a lot of, well, there's a lot of issues going on. If you look at the sustainability agenda, we want to, of course, be focusing on climate and the environment. But there's all these competing issues that are the top of companies' agendas: AI, geopolitical issues, economic uncertainty, war. And so climate and environment is slipping down that agenda. So what we were trying to do was highlight some of the tensions that we're facing, this tension between short-termism and still having to focus on the long-term, about the types of leadership that we need for the future compared to, I think, what we're kind of going through today. The risks that we're facing are companies being, are setting themselves up for resilience and the visibility of hidden dependencies. Are we factoring externalities into the way our businesses are structured?
We'll talk about that in detail just in a second. Just for simplicity's sake, here here in this conversation. I think you, Emily, you represent the pragmatist because you will talk to us about how big international corporations think. And you, Marina, are the idealist with this idea about the donut economy, and we will navigate through those ideas. But before we continue, I'd like to know what the issue is to you. Why do you care about this subject? Marina, I'll start with you.
Sure. I think caring for the environment for me really came as a child. I grew up in California, and there basically were Earth Day celebrations in kindergarten. So it was already very much part of our lifestyle. I think the environment has always been close to my heart. And living in Switzerland then for 14 years enabled me to experience glacial melt firsthand and the sadness that it brings. When you see entire landscapes eroding, you hear the mountains and the permafrost melting and the rocks crashing into these valleys. So environmental issues really started to come home for me physically in Switzerland. And then I began to not only want to write about it and talk about it, but do something about it. And that's why I'm here.
Emily, and for you?
So I joined the Economist Intelligence Unit in 2008, which is part of the Economist Group. And one of the first projects that I started working on was something called the European Green City Index with a large infrastructure company in Germany. And it became clear to me that this was not just an issue. It wasn't just about emissions. We looked at cities from across different categories, transport, policymaking, civil society, wastewater, all of these different things. And it became clear that this is a really systemic issue and much more challenging than I had previously understood. So that was, I suppose, an awakening. We presented it at COP15, which was in Copenhagen and was seen at the time as being pretty much a disaster. But I suppose the action part came when I had my second daughter. I was carrying her in my Manduka with those ergo baby carriers. And I was reading Cormac McCarthy's book, The Road, which is probably not a good combination with having a baby. And it's this kind of apocalyptic landscape, what happens after a climate disaster. And I just felt, I'm going to leave my kids with, what am I doing? You know, how can I do something to have a positive impact for my children? And what can I leave behind?
And did The Economist have a sustainability officer at that point? Or did you create that position?
Well, The Economist has been writing about climate change for a long time, since the late 80s, when James Hansen, the NASA scientist, testified in front of the US Congress that climate change was an issue. And we've been covering it ever since. But we published in 2019 the so-called climate issue. And in that issue, climate was tackled in every single article that we published to show that it touches whatever we write about, whether it's science or technology, whether it's economics, whether it's, you know, human rights. So everything that we talked about. And actually, I was working together with Marina at the time, we're ex-colleagues, and an initiative was started, not just to look at this external issues of climate change, but what impact are we having as the Economist group and newspaper on our external environment? And a grassroots initiative was formed at the time. And so the role kind of developed out of that. But that was the start of the journey.
And this issue that you mentioned, the climate issue, was that shocking to your readers? Did people protest? I mean, was that new?
No, I think it was new. And I know that the journalists that were working on it, they had lots of internal discussions as, is that something that they could publish? But they felt, yes, this is something we should do. So it was through the whole edition, right through to the obituary, which was about a glacier that had died in Iceland. And they, at that time, felt it was the right move. And then we didn't have a backlash from our readers.
No.
No.
That's surprising.
Perhaps it was the time where there was much more of an open discussion about
climate.
It was
the Fridays for Future time, no? 2019.
Yes, yeah. It was around that time where there was much more of a movement. There was much more, I suppose, interest in the topic from across all aspects of society, wanting to understand the issue and I think a lack of knowledge. So it was something that our readers were interested in.
We'll get back to that right away. But at the beginning of the conversation, I always like to bring in a big number that makes us understand why we talk about it, why this matters. So this time I chose a number from the World Economic Forum. So they're not exactly leftists or like dreamy idealists, but they published a survey. And the number that I'm going to mention is 80, because this recent study that they published showed that 80% of business leaders say that circularity is important or very important to their organization. And that number more than doubled in only 3 years. So that's big. and that number is expected to rise. I will put the link to the study in the show notes for you to look it up. So we have a big number, 80. 80% of business leaders say that circularity is important. Emily, wow, a huge number. Why now? Because at the same time, we hear ESG is dead, the Green Deal is dead, European governments are scaling back their climate policies. How do you explain that number? And do you think green growth is really dead? Or what's happening here?
There's a lot of questions.
Yeah, I know. But, you know, it's 80 versus this movement that we seem to see everywhere that nobody cares about climate anymore.
Well, I mean, I think there's a couple of topics. It seems that nobody's caring about the climate anymore. And I think it's a bit more nuanced than that. Are companies stepping away from having targets at all? And we'll come back to the circularity issue in a moment, because I think that's a slightly different one, the World Economic Forum data point that you're giving. I don't think companies are stepping away from their targets. They may be in some regions. So the CDP State of Decarbonization report, analysing all of the data from the companies that they collect annually, showed that policy engagement may be influencing the scores of US and Brazilian companies. They were scoring lower on leadership and management categories, the way that the CDP scores companies compared to companies in other economies.
Maybe you can explain what CDP is.
Sorry, the Carbon Disclosure Project. So it measures and it scores companies across lots of different factors, emissions measurements, working towards targets, the types of governance that they have in place. And 23,000 to 25,000 companies report to the CDP every year. So it's a good benchmark. And at the same time, PwC has also been looking at the number of companies, PricewaterhouseCoopers, I think they are actually called PwC these days, so they've rebranded themselves, are setting targets. So about 8 in 10 companies still have targets. They're either, some of them are accelerating their targets, but they're holding fast to their targets. So there's this talk of a sense of we've moved from greenwashing, which is where, you know, companies would set these targets that were pretty much nonsensical and they weren't really working towards and had no way of getting towards it, to companies being much quieter about it and this sense of greenwashing. Circularity is a slightly different topic because I think that's where companies can also make money. So they can drive value from waste. And so some of the examples of companies that are looking at circularity, certainly in hard to abate sectors, are generating money from actually looking at a circular approach because they're driving efficiencies, things that they are extracting and otherwise just getting rid of. Well, we can actually use that as a product or a product stream. Is ESG dead? I mean, I think it's changed. We have written that it's dead. You know, this ESG was not fit for purpose and it was shoehorned into a framework that companies felt was not helpful. I think regulation, particularly in the EU, was really difficult for companies. If we look at the CSRD, the Corporate Sustainability Reporting Directive, which came into place initially for companies, I think you did see companies looking into the headlights. They had 1,200 to 1,600 indicators that they had to report on. They were putting, you know, in some cases for large organizations, hundreds of people in place just to work on reporting. I don't think that's efficient for companies. So I think the omnibus, which was simplifying some of the reporting guidelines, was a better approach because you want companies to be able to take that information, as we talked about earlier, what are the hidden dependencies and how can I work with that information to form their strategy rather than just some sort of reporting exercise.
So you're basically saying that the circular economy is a way to move forward and actually do something good for the environment and reduce emissions. And that's more acceptable to companies because there's a business case in it.
Yeah, I think it can, in that case, improve business economics.
Because we want to reduce dependencies, or why now?
Well, I mean, there's certainly guidance coming to place, regulations coming into place in Europe, also in the US, so that will change the way companies are able to use their products. But I think companies are just, they're feeling that they should be moving away from this extractive approach. And there is, you know, coming back to Marina's point about planetary boundaries, there is a limit to what we can extract. At some point, if you're in a mining organization or a concrete organization, you rely on resources that you're basically digging out of the ground. If you're just digging it out and then wasting things, there's a limit to how far you can go with that. So you then would use those products and turn that into value.
But we've known for a very long time that this is a concept that cannot last. But now we seem to understand that we really have to change the way we do business.
Yeah.
So why now? Is it because of pricing or availability or the wars we're seeing? Why has the time come that we finally understand this?
I don't know. That's a question I can't answer.
I mean, I think it is really the perspective is just starting to form that policymakers have understood that we do have a planetary crisis. And I think the COPs and the political process up to date is leading to this action, which is why the EU is creating this regulation. So there is recognition. I think the challenges are still within the systemic nature. And so particularly on, you know, raw materials like cement industry, the abundance is still there. It's still cheaper to produce. It's much cheaper to produce cement according to legacy technology than it is to actually make green cement. The green premium is just huge. So right now, we're at a moment where policy has recognized that action needs to be taken, but business is struggling to make the business case work in many, many instances. And that's why the sustainability challenge is so prevalent.
I think the energy argument is a lot easier to understand.
That is, we don't have enough energy to go on.
Energy security. We've already gone through the Ukraine-Russia war. And we saw also with our suppliers in Germany, they were cutting off. You could access gas for a certain number of hours per day. Well, that affects the amount of product that you're able to produce if you're relying on gas. So we've seen in our supply chain, our suppliers moving to electric combined heat power plants because they want to have more energy security because the costs were too high. So I think the argument around energy security is very clear, and lots of organizations are working towards that because renewable energy is more reliable and it's cheaper at times like these. But the circularity argument, I think, is certainly a slightly different one.
But let's talk about the circularity argument, Marina. At the Impact Days, you explained how the donut economy works, and you gave a few examples. For instance, you talked about the outdoors clothing company Patagonia, and they take a lot of the boxes that would fit the concept of the donut economy. What are they doing right? Explain to us.
So Patagonia has always been a bit of a flagship company when it comes to their sustainability initiatives because they take it really at a holistic level, you know, being pioneers on material reduction targets, climate targets, and so on. But what makes them really different is the organizational structure that is allowing them to ensure that their purpose as an organization is linked to their sustainability performance forever. So in 2022, Patagonia chose to go purpose instead of being listed on the stock market, to go public, and actually made Earth its main shareholder while still being a for-profit business. And what this means is that it basically has a steward ownership model where Patagonia has been able to separate money and power in the ownership model itself, which enables the sustainability actions and the decision-making that's needed to be able to do that.
Okay, let's take one step back. If they don't grow like other companies, other clothing, outdoor clothing companies, how do they stay competitive in a market?
So they do grow. And I think that's the wonderful thing about a steward ownership model. It doesn't mean that a company cannot generate profits and be sustainable. The difference is that the profits that it generates are reinvested back into the business primarily to enable the organization to grow and for sustainability measures to be implemented.
Instead of giving the money to shareholders.
Giving the money to shareholders, where the money effectively disappears for the organization's purposes, but is a dividend for someone else or is improving someone else's wealth, where there was not a direct relationship between that wealth and the value that has been generated.
But as you said, inside of the donut, there are all these categories like fair wages, give me the
health,
other example.
Education.
How do they incorporate those?
So obviously, there are two components to an international business like Patagonia's. I mean, one is the people that are actually working for the organization directly. And then the second component is the people that are working in the companies that produce the products that it is actually selling. And I think in the first instance, everything that is owned within the company there, they can very easily, you know, ensure that their people are paid fairly. I'm sure they are probably well above market rates. But in the supply chain, this is where we're getting into this dimension where we do have situations where clothing manufacturers in Asia are not paying living wages. And there is a relatively high percentage, I think it's about 40% of people who are working within Patagonia's supply chain are still not receiving a living wage. And that's because of the structures of the fashion and clothing industry that are at a global level.
Okay, you're talking about a shortfall that even a company like Patagonia cannot avoid at this point. Yeah. But let's try to understand what they do right at the beginning. I mean, I looked at their sustainability report and it's so very detailed how and where they save emissions and reduce emissions. Maybe you can explain a little how that works.
Absolutely. And I haven't worked with Patagonia directly, but definitely looking at their public reporting, I mean, they have very ambitious goals on secondary waste. So that means the products that they actually produce are going to be coming back into their value chain. They have a strategic focus on repair and reuse and actually making that part of the business model. So the most important part is to extend the longevity of the product that you actually produce, ensure that people aren't buying jackets all the time because this jacket is of poor quality. So if we remember the campaign, it was...
Don't buy this jacket.
Buy this jacket. I mean, it's sending out anti-consumer messages. And certainly that's a contribution to moving away from fast fashion. If you're wearing the same jacket for 15 to 20 years, then you haven't bought a new one.
Okay, but the question is, how do they still make money if they tell people not to buy a jacket?
So right now they are growing revenue by increasing market share. And I think from an overall perspective and from an environmental perspective, we should all be happy that Patagonia is increasing market share, because the profits that they do then deliver, 1% of profits are donated to climate causes and the rest is reinvested back to the business. So if you actually can imagine a company like Patagonia becoming even larger and more successful, that still feels like a good thing.
Marina, you mentioned a few times steward ownership. What does that mean? Can you explain?
Sure. The steward ownership model means that a company really locks in its purpose and has an ownership structure which prevents it from moving away from that purpose and even being sold. So in Patagonia's case, it has this Holdfast Collective, which is owning 98% of the company, and that part has non-voting shares. And the Patagonia Purpose Trust holds 2% and owns 100% of the voting stock. So that means that the team that is actually managing the company cannot decide to move away from the mission that it has actually aligned to, and that locks it in.
How does that sound to you, Emily? Is that a one-off, or can other companies learn from Patagonia? Is that a business model that's applicable to many? Or is that kind of a dreamy idealist thing? You know, a lot of people criticize the donut economy for being, you know, very lofty idealist. How do you see that?
I think the ownership model that Marina was talking about is the key point.
The steward ownership.
The ownership. Not necessarily the steward ownership, but actually who owns the company. So I did some research aside from my job. I was working on a piece of group research as part of a university project not that long ago, not when I was an actual student, because that would be 30 years ago. But it looked at companies in the consumer goods industry, including Colgate, Henkel, Beiersdorf, Unilever. And one of the key findings that we had in that project, that the consumer goods companies are bound, that are listed, are bound by fiduciary duty. And that does have a limitation on what they can do. They have a fiduciary duty to deliver shareholder value. Otherwise, they can be sued by their shareholders. But independent companies, and some of these are where the family is still involved, the German companies, you know, Henkel, Beiersdorf, they had much more flexibility. And you could see that in the detail of their decarbonization strategies and how effectively they were working towards that. So I think that role of ownership is very important. I mean, we have a slight parallel at the Economist newspaper, not with regards to the environment, but we have a trustee model that defends the independence of the newspaper. We have four trustees that don't have any voting rights in terms of the company, but they make decisions on this independence of the newspaper. And the board is separate to that. And we have an employee shareholder program, although, you know, the employees don't have voting rights. But you can see that types of things can be very much protected. And that's what makes The Economist, in comparison to other newspapers, quite unique. We don't have a majority shareholder. Again, that's has to do with our journalism, not to do with environment or biodiversity or nature. But it just shows how important this ownership model actually is.
So that basically says that listed companies are for them it's much harder.
I think it's much harder. They have also a duty to the economy. They are seen as a driver of the economy by the government. So if you're Unilever, of course, you're expected to a certain extent to employ people, to be a driver of growth. And I think that makes it incredibly challenging to make fundamental changes.
Do you see a way that listed companies could still do it or not?
It's not clear to me, looking at the donut model, how they would do that. I don't know how that would happen, because I think the way that our structures are in place, and again, because we can't see organizations independently. We can't also point the finger just at businesses. Businesses exist in an economy along with the finance sector, along with governments, and these three players act together. If you want to rewire the economy, if you want to rewire change, then you need to look at actions across all of these three different areas. And it's not just something that business can drive on its own. It needs to be incentivized or supported by the finance industry. It needs to be supported by government policy and regulation.
My question is how? We've talked about businesses themselves and what kind of initiatives they can do, but how does the financial industry need to change, or what can governments do?
Well, I mean, I think regulation is a key area. We were coming back to the point of regulation and the Green Deal. We were talking about it earlier. I do think regulation does have a key role to play in encouraging companies to make the right choices.
This Should is from create... The Economist, a liberal
we
newspaper.
We do write about that, though. You know, we talk about the need for the Paris Agreement, that how important that is in guiding countries towards the nationally determined contributions towards a net zero target. There's a scientific argument for a net zero target. I mean, that's absolutely what we write about. It's the science. But you do need to have some sort of policies in place to encourage the right type of action. Should you have a lot of red tape that's discouraging companies from being active? No. Are there other things that could be done? Yes. I mean, we write extensively about the need for a carbon tax, and that a carbon tax would be more effective in encouraging change, that reducing subsidies on fossil fuels would have a bigger impact. So I think there are a lot of levers that we are not using that could be used more effectively. And these are topics that we cover in the newspaper and across all of our data analysis of the EIU, the Economist Intelligence Unit, our events. So we do discuss this on a wide level.
I'm surprised to hear this from The Economist. I mean, of course, I read it in the articles, but still, The Economist is considered a liberal magazine that's very business friendly. And our political parties that claim to be business friendly argue exactly against what you have just said. They're trying to keep subsidies in place. It's taking them a long time to do away with them. They're against carbon pricing or trying to put it off to the future. What do you say?
Well, I think it's challenging. I mean, see that Mark Carney was trying to introduce a carbon tax, had to slightly change it because there was a lot of pushback from the regular citizen on the street that it would impact. So I think it has to be handled in a way that regular individuals are not having to pay the price of carbon tax. So I do think it has to be handled very carefully, but there is a role for these types of instruments. And, you know, fossil fuel subsidies, it's $7 trillion that are being paid to fossil fuels. Could that go into other types of technologies? Yes, I think it could. And that's something that I think governments should be exploring.
Even conservative parties.
Well.
But tell us a little bit about The Economist as a publishing house. You've described the ownership structure a little bit, but publishing is resource intensive.
Yeah.
You have logistics to deal with, you have printing, you have all these things. How do you make it sustainable? What's your job there?
So we started measuring our footprint at the same time as we published the climate issue in 2019. And since then, we've reduced our footprint by 34%, a science-based target in 2021 to reduce our emissions by 43% by 2030. So in line with the net zero ambition. The key lever has been paper. So paper is highly energy intensive. It uses a huge amount of energy and water to get the trees. You know, you cut down the trees and you turn it into pulp and make incredibly thin paper. And one of the levers that was pricing. So nudging customers to make a more sustainable choice. Originally, when we had a bundle edition of The Economist, you would receive print and digital together in your subscription. But we changed the pricing that digital was the base. And if you wanted the print edition, you'd pay extra for that. And that had a huge impact on our footprint, and our emissions reduced very quickly after that. So 5 years ago, we had 65% of our readers were print, and today it's 65% are digital. So it's really changed our footprint to digital first business. Of course, it comes with relying on more data centers and more energy storage. So that's a question mark, of course, as to, you know, how that is going to change our footprint in the future. We're starting to see a slight increase in what we call the use phase emissions, which is, you know, you go on your laptop or you go on your phone and you consume The Economist videos or on the app. So we are seeing now a slight increase there. So how that will play out in the future, we don't know. But the paper transportation waste from the newspaper was at least the significant part of our footprint, and we've done big steps to reduce that so far.
And has becoming digital made your business cheaper to produce?
Well, it's more cost effective, yeah.
So it's more cost effective, but the effect on the environment is yet to be seen, because you don't know if all the data centers and all that will kind of compensate the positive effects.
But we work in an initiative called Zimpact, which is a group of media companies, which includes the BBC, Spotify, Netflix, Cambridge University Press, a whole load of different publishers, print, digital, broadcasters. And we're all looking at this issue, you know, mapping out the emissions impact of our footprint from the actual writing or content creation through to how it's being delivered on the internet, how people are consuming that, and starting to develop levers that we believe are available to us as an industry to reduce that. But one of the things that we're keen to understand is the actual impact of data centers and potentially AI. And so we're working together as an industry to try and understand, or trying to improve the transparency of information that we're receiving.
Are there any donut aspects in your business? Publishing business?
Absolutely. I mean, if you just think about what we do, we have a very clear purpose. We are an independent newspaper. We're analyzing the facts. We're trying to make the world and all of the chaos that we talked about earlier on understandable for our readers. And we have a huge role to play in that. We're translating what's going on in the world for our readers, and particularly in terms of climate, you know, what impact does that have? We reach a very influential audience of senior decision makers that can make decisions within their organizations to change the way they're operating. And we talk about this, I mean, my journalist colleagues would not love this word, but we talk about brain print in our industry association.
The brain print. What is that?
The impact of our content on our readers.
Instead of
versus
imprint.
The footprint, exactly.
Or footprint. Okay.
Yeah. So this whole purpose, we know what our mission is. We know what we're there for. It's very clear. Reaching our audiences, having a positive impact. We have a foundation that we run to educate children on media literacy. It's called the Economist Educational Foundation. We actively work with communities. I'm also the chair of our charitable trust. We have project grants that we issue every year to the communities that we're working in. So I think there are lots of aspects of what we do where we are considering not just running our business, but very much what are we there for? What's our purpose? And how can we additionally have a positive impact on the communities we're working in?
I'll remember the word brain print.
Yeah.
That leads me to the question, do you think that companies are ahead of politics? That they know that they have to change and they're more courageous than politicians?
That's a hard question. I think if you had asked me that maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I would have said yes. I think now it's hard to know. I think companies are probably acting slightly below the parapet. There's this greenwashing. I think I mentioned that earlier. I think companies are careful, much more careful at the moment about what they are saying externally. And are they acting ahead of regulations? You take examples like Patagonia, absolutely. Or there are lots of different examples of companies that are trying to work ahead. Or you know, we have a science-based target. That's voluntary. We don't need to do that. We don't need to do all of the reporting. So I think there is, but it's certainly a bit quieter, I would say, on that
okay.
front.
Okay. I'd like to sum up this topic. You know, a lot of politicians, they say the market will fix it, the technology will fix it. I understand from you that you disagree. We do need regulation.
I think technology will help. Technology does play an important role, and it could be something basic as adapting or being more resilient to the climate risks that we're going to face. So it could be something like air conditioning is available to people in countries where it's going to become incredibly hot, that they can be resilient to the heat. It could be the transition to green energy, to renewables. It could be things like carbon removal. We talk about geoengineering, geothermal. Are these things that we want to have? No, but it's about adapting and being resilient. Are they going to solve the climate crisis? No, they are not. They are going to help, they are going to, I suppose, manage parts of that. But if we do get to this worst case scenario, which is a 3-degree world and more, then of course technology will help to a certain extent, but it's not going to solve the problem.
So we need legislation to limit emissions in each country.
Yes.
And a path.
Well, yes.
Well, in Austria, we've been struggling to pass a law for exactly that for, I don't know, 3 years now. Marina, I'm moving back to you because you're also advising the city of Vienna in terms of implementing donut economic principles. Give us a rough idea of what that would entail.
Sure. I think the way the city of Vienna has already referenced donut economic principles within its circularity strategy is basically a great place to start and fits perfectly with the core theme of your podcast. It's really about recognizing the global responsibility that the city has on one hand, and then devising really, really concrete actions and measurement instances that can actually be taken to deliver on these goals. So within the circularity strategy, the city of Vienna has done some excellent work to establish what is its material footprint, how much are its citizens consuming every year, how much waste are we producing.
So what are we doing right in Vienna?
So what we're doing right is that we have understood the problem and set targets. That's literally the stage where we are at the moment, and have a number of great initiatives in place. I think the vision that we're starting to see, you know, from a circularity perspective, is that it can also be turned into a business opportunity to create more local employment, create therefore better economic resilience locally, come up with the brand Made in Vienna, to be working with material reuse solutions where you can actually have people producing clothing which is made from used materials and redesigning it into a way which is fashionable and popular.
So basically, cities, municipalities play a big role in pushing businesses, local businesses.
Absolutely. And creating incentives and frameworks and also regulatory guidelines on things like, you know, what can go to waste and what cannot go to waste. I think on circularity, you know, it's also about pricing raw materials versus reused materials. Right now, we're in the situation where reused materials simply are obviously more expensive because of the systems that need to be created. But cities can help by creating the infrastructure to do that.
Austria has a strategy, a policy on the circular economy. The city of Vienna has one. Is that just patient paper, as we would say in German? How would you know that these policies have any effect? How do we measure success here?
I think the circularity rate is a good measure of success. So that is something that is going to be...
That describes how many raw materials are being reused.
Are reused within
the economy. And that's about 14% at the moment in Austria. Is that correct? That's not a lot.
It's not a lot at all. And then there are other criteria which you can use, which is actually like the level of waste that we produce. You know, you will know that our economy has become circular when we don't throw anything away anymore and really follow the cycles of nature, if you will, of you have everything that can be either biodegraded or recycled or reused and put back into the cycle, then we will have a completely different shape of an economy. So in the short term, the government needs to seize the business opportunity of this transformation. And in the long term, overall, our economic resilience on resource-intensive industries needs to be reduced, ideally, and we need to be shifting to regenerative business models that can be phased in to be creating this local employment and reducing our reliance on extractive fossil fuel industries over time.
But this would shape the way the Austrian economy is set up because we rely very heavily on heavy industry.
Indeed. And I think that's where we need creative minds. We need people to have a different vision for a future. We need to be asking, what should our world look like? What do we want to have to enable our children a happy future?
Okay.
According to a Context Institute study, the export of recycling machinery and recycled materials can generate 2.2 billion euros in additional value creation and 20,300 additional jobs in Austria. So it sort of becomes a question, why don't we do this?
Why don't we do this?
We are continuing to uphold business models which do not necessarily have success written on them for the long term.
And is that because of old structures in terms of lobbyist groups, or what's the root of?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a general recognition of how urgent this transformation needs to be. Overall, challenges with change management, not wanting to be agile enough to change before disruption happens. We need to wait for disruption to happen before we change. Why? And it is absolutely people that have successful, thriving businesses running on old business models, they will also be happier to keep them that way. This is where we need to invite new forms of bold leadership and have policymakers be making stronger policy initiatives to be operating in the interest of society, not only business.
So this is very much a leadership issue.
Absolutely. We need new politicians that are also articulating these points and are willing to put forward a generational solution. And I think we need to have a new economic narrative that demonstrates that we're not entirely reliant on industries of the past and that we worry less about letting go, but moving towards something positive instead of talking about the risk of what we're losing. Let's start build on what's next, not on what used to be.
Is there anything you wish from the Austrian government? Should anyone hear this?
Climate law, perhaps.
Klimaschutzgesetz.
Would be good. Step number one. And I would also really wish more work to be done, actually, on the food and agricultural sector.
I've got another point. I was talking about, you know, the ownership and the shareholder influence earlier. But I think I'm seeing really positive signals from the hard-to-abate sector in terms of circularity that I think are really positive. And what you were saying is where you get to the point where you're not wasting things. I mean, we work with pulp and paperware manufacturers. We work with, you know, large organizations. And I've spent quite a lot of time, you know, speaking to them about waste streams and are they looking at, you know, what do they do with their waste? And they say, well, we don't have waste. We use everything that comes from the trees. I think it's incredibly interesting. They manage their forests very well. They cut down the trees. Of course, they're burning some of it as biofuel, but they use the waste from the papermaking process. They use the lignin. They're capturing some of the carbon for reuse. So it's actually quite an interesting sector and they're trying to innovate. So I think if you start seeing it happening in the hard to abate sector, it certainly sends a signal that this is, you know, it's quite a positive impact.
You're trying to end on a positive note.
Yeah.
To sum this up.
I am seeing positive.
Yeah. So to sum this up, in Europe, how far are we on our path to go full circle?
Are you looking for a number?
Just a rough estimate. Where are we standing now?
I think, honestly, we've got quite a ways to go. I think companies are trying hard. I think some industries are ahead of the curve. I've talked about pulp and paper. I think they're doing pretty well. But I think, you know, I think we've got quite a long way to go.
That means we have 10%, 20% of the circle or less global circularity gap or global circularity rate is by 6%.
I think circularity is also, I would say, a fairly new...
We're at square one.
Yeah, exactly. It's a new concept that we're starting at.
Well, we have a lot to talk about. We contributed to the conversation today. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Das war's für heute bei Full Circle. Wenn dir die Folge gefallen hat, dann schau in unsere Shownotes. Dort findest du den direkten Link zu unserem Substack-Newsletter und unserer Steady-Community. Mit eurem Support über Steady können wir Full Circle weiterhin unabhängig produzieren. Und wir bedanken uns auch für die Startförderung von der Wirtschaftsagentur Wien. Bis zum nächsten Mal.